Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, and I'm George Knapp, your occasional host, coming to you tonight from the heart of the Mojave Desert and the most outrageous city in the world, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. I hope you're pumped tonight, because I certainly am. I can't imagine a better lineup of guests for one program, and in reality, we could easily fill five or six excellent programs with these guys, but we'll take this group any way we can get them. I have mentioned to you a couple of times in the past that the one guest I've always wanted, the person who's writing an opinion on UFOs and paranormal topics, I take most seriously. The person I consider to be the deepest thinker ever to broach these subjects that we cover on the program each week is Dr. Jacques Vallée. And I've been trying to get him on the show ever since I started hosting a couple of years ago. Tonight, finally, he's here to talk about his newest book. It's called Wonders in the Sky, and it's an exquisite companion to his earlier landmark books that he's written, in particular Passport to Magonia. I am very pleased to say that Jacques Vallée will be here for the first 2 hours tonight, starting in just a minute or two. And in hours three and four, two men who are well-known to Coast listeners. Bryce Zabel is a former network newsman who became a writer and producer of such fare as the groundbreaking TV series Dark Skies. Also worked with Steven Spielberg on the miniseries Taken. He's become something of a major player inside the industry in the Academy of Motion Pictures. His writing partner these days is none other than Richard Dolan, the historian whose monumental books on UFOs and the national security state easily rank among the most important on the UFO subject ever written. Rich has been on the show with me a couple of times. It's always an enlightening experience to have him here. He is as sharp as they come. These two have combined their considerable talents into a what-if look, or maybe not what-if, but when disclosure happens. The book is called AD, After Disclosure, and it's a wonderful, imaginative, and sobering look at how our world would change from the macro scale to the micro, what it would mean to your everyday life if the presence of others, some other intelligence, was acknowledged by our government, the media, the world. It's an amazing accomplishment and a fun read, and will be coming out from the publisher tomorrow. But we have the authors here tonight, coming up in hours three and four. Tim Binal is my webmaster tonight. We have an assortment of Knapp's news items accumulated for your reading pleasure. But for gosh sakes, don't read the material during the interview segments, because you're not going to want to miss any of this. I'm going to our first break now, and when we come back, strap yourselves in, Jacques Vallée and Wonders of the Sky. Stay with us for a great program tonight on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. I'm George Knapp. In my personal library at home, I probably have 2,000 books on the UFO subject and related stuff. I've got them stacked on shelves and in boxes in categories, but there's only one author who gets his own shelf, is his own category, and that's Jacques Vallée. I had the pleasure of meeting Dr. Vallée back in 1989, and we've had occasional contact since then. I've told you my opinion of his work, as I think it's the most important thoughts ever written on the subject. He has more than once changed the entire UFO paradigm, changed the direction of the research and the focus, or at least tried to, once with a book called Passport to Magonia, which was the first to note the similarities between modern tales of UFOs and ETs and much older stories about fairies and goblins and lights and objects in the sky. And his newest book, co-written with Chris Aubeck, is a perfect companion, I think, to Magonia. Wonders in the Sky, it's called. It looks at unexplained aerial objects from antiquity up until the dawn of the Industrial Revolution. And why are these old cases of any interest to anyone? I'll let Jacques Vallée explain that for himself. Jacques, great to have you here.
Good evening, George. Always a pleasure.
I had the pleasure of finishing the book yesterday. It's a wonderful book, and I hope a lot of people check it out. How do you sell this idea to a publisher? You know, you go in and say, hey, we're writing a book about UFOs, but we're only looking at cases that happened a long time ago and mostly in other countries pre-1900s.
It's not easy. It's not easy. But I think they remember Passport to Magonia. And some, you know, there are publishers now who are knowledgeable about the subject and were intrigued with the approach that we took. And, of course, when you start reading this material, it's like discovering a treasure. So I think the people at Tarcher Penguin caught on and became as enthusiastic as we were.
The argument could be made, and I'm sure it will be made by people who like to jump on this kind of stuff, that these cases are old. Some of them date back to like the 8th or 9th century. How do you give them any credence? There's no video. There's no photos. These were country bumpkins living in a non-technological age. Why should we even consider the cases?
That's the first reaction. If you remember, that's also the reaction people had initially to a passport to Magogna, that this is vague folklore. And, it's not vague folklore because, remember, these are the cases who went through history, down through history, all the way to us. And they were, for them to have been recorded the way they were recorded, they had to be felt to be very important to that civilization. The consuls in Rome made a rule that every year there had to be a record given to them of any unexplained object in the sky. And the reason for this was that they, for astrological reasons, it was felt that any strange object in the sky could announce new wars or the fall of empires, the fall of an emperor, and the birth of an exceptional person, and so on. Most of those, of course, were meteors and comets, which are very interesting to astronomers, because we can now go back and trace back the Halley's Comet, for example, all the way to the Roman Empire. But many of those were unexplained. It's a little bit as if, President Obama said to the Air Force, I demand to have a quarterly report on UFOs on my desk at the White House. Those were very important. Some of those records were lost, but many of them had been saved by historians who republished them in their own books, and we were able to trace them. We separated the explainable cases, again, the meteors, the aurora borealis, the comets, and so on, from those that remained unexplained. And those were felt to be very important. We have many records that come from the records of the churches in different countries and different civilizations. We go back to a couple of Egyptian cases that were actually engraved in stone. So for somebody to go to the trouble of erecting a stela in the middle of the desert, saying this is where the pharaoh and his army saw this strange object in the sky, that must have been felt to be very important. These are actually better authenticated and better described in many cases than what you read in the newspaper every day.
Plus, it's you have to consider what you're weeding out. You purposely stop it in the 1890s at the onset of the Industrial Revolution, before there were balloons, before there were airplanes, so that there could be no mistaking any of these cases for something that humans are flying. It's also long before there was any kind of disinformation or Photoshop or anything of that sort.
Absolutely. And some of those cases came from people who were leaders in science or in the arts. Michelangelo, for example, saw a triangle in the sky and painted it. The painting is lost, unfortunately, but it's known from art historians that that he saw this and felt it was important enough for him to do a painting of it.
You have some 500 or more cases. How'd you gather them all, and how do you sift through them and in selecting the ones that are most pertinent?
Well, it's very simple. It takes 6 years, and it takes a network. Of course, this was only made possible by the Internet. I could not do that. I published Passport to Magogna 40 years ago, and everybody has criticized it with good reason, because there were some inaccuracies in the book, but nobody has redone it, because it would be a lot of work to redo it. Let me tell you about my co-author, Chris Obeck, because Chris is this book in many ways is his work. He took the initiative. He did most of the historical research. He's a scholar, much younger than I am. So in a way, this is a generation transition here. He represents, I think, a new generation of people doing this kind of research on the paranormal, especially in Europe, who have a completely different view of the reality of the phenomenon and what it could mean. He's something of a cultural anthropologist and a student of history and language. He's an Englishman who lives in Madrid, and extremely extremely precise in the research he does. And he contacted me because he wanted us to go over the material that I had started to nibble at in Passport to Magogna. When I wrote Magogna, I was well aware that I was just scratching the surface, that there must be scholars, there must be historians, museum curators, and so on, who were sitting on enormous reserves of information that was relevant. And, you know, before then, I had pretty much followed the extraterrestrial approach. I mean, certainly my first contact with the problem was, gee, you know, we know there is life throughout the universe, there must be. And these objects look like spacecraft. Except that in science, you have to ask the question, when did it start? That's certainly one of the important questions, and it certainly did not start with Kenneth Arnold in 1947. It didn't start with the cloud cigars and the, you know, the cigar-shaped objects in America during the 1897 wave, because we have records before then. So I started to look at this. But Chris had assembled a network of people, about 10 people, on the Internet from Russia and Latin America and the U.S. and Germany and so on, who were digging up sources in the literature. And we merged our databases, his and mine, and then we started using his network to go after original sources. And here you have, you know, you have to realize that in the literature there are some references to old cases, but they are they don't give you the original source. They say, you know, two discs flew over London in 1800 and so on. Well, if you go back to the original source, it says there were two lights seen over London. It doesn't say anything about discs. So if you want an accurate picture, you have to go back in as many cases as you can to the original record. And that's what Chris and his team did. And then we, you know, we started working and accumulating this. For every case, we stopped at 500 cases between antiquity and 1879. For every case we kept, we rejected 5 or 10 that were actually just lights in the sky or meteors or could have been anything. And so it was, you know, it was a labor of love. Once we started, the material is just so fascinating that you get just drawn into it. It's absolutely beautiful.
Of course, a central message here, and I'll let you express it, but one of the central themes is that the same things basically have been seen for a long time, basically throughout human history, though we might use different terms to describe them. The people back there, in some of the cases in your book, refer to flying shields, not flying saucers. They talk about, in China, flying dragons, reflecting sort of cultural values of the time and place. Are these cases... Do you think these cases are reporting the same things that we see and report now, just describing them differently, or do you think these objects appear in different forms to reflect the times?
In this book, we're very careful not to... We don't even propose any theory. We just wanted to go over the material and put it before other scholars. We see this book as a beginning. In a way, Passport to Magogna was a beginning, but this is really a new beginning. We hope to alert there must be a lot more that we haven't discovered. One of the beauties, of course, of the Internet today, and you know I'm a great fan of the Internet professionally, is that museums and newspapers and archives and so on are putting all their collections now online. So it's a lot easier to search through that material than it was, you know, even 10 years ago. So we've actually done the best we could at producing this, but there must be a lot more. There must be, you know, in the attics of castles in Germany and Austria and France and Britain, there must be piles of records and manuscripts and correspondence that should be looked at. And so we're trying to alert librarians and scholars and historians to note that material and record it and bring it to our attention. Also, of course, we're much better at reading French and English or German than reading, you know, ancient Chinese or ancient writing from Japan. So we need to enlist the energy and the scholarship of people, of researchers in Asia and in other places in the world. So that's what we hope the book will do. It will be a beginning. When we analyze the patterns in these 500 cases, the patterns that emerge are absolutely similar to patterns we extract from contemporary databases. And that's where we're tempted to say this is the same phenomenon. It's always been with us.
You assert in the book that alien contact might be mankind's oldest story, that these incidents have always been with us in one form or another, and that they have changed the course of history in some cases. Can you give examples?
Certainly. And it's not just me saying that. I'm just quoting scholars like Professor Cugliano at the University of Chicago, who spoke of the travel to the stars as the oldest story of humanity. There was what I love particularly the stories from China, because the people who wrote those records, of course, were the scholars and the poets. Most of the, there's one from the 13th century, for example, June 3rd, 1277 in China. Strange event seen at dawn. And this was written by Liu Ying, who was a Chinese poet of the Yuan dynasty. And his book was called The Yuan Literature Collection, Event Seen at Dawn. I rise at dawn, and through the window I see a very bright star that crosses the Milky Way. Now I see three luminous objects appear in the southern sky, of which two fly away and disappear suddenly from my sight. The one which remains possesses five unequal lights beneath it. You're beginning to see that this is not an ordinary light in the sky. And above its upper part, I see something in the form of a dome. The unknown object begins to move in zigzag, like a dead leaf. Well, if you remember, we have lots of stories. One of the characteristic motions of modern UFOs is a dead leaf motion. He continues, at the same time, some fiery thing falls from the sky. A short time afterwards, the sun rises, but its brightness is dulled by the luminous object that moves quickly in a northerly direction. So by now, it must have been in the sky for a fairly long time. So this is not just a passing thing in the sky. In the western sky, a green cloud is suddenly disturbed by another unknown object, oval in shape, flat, that descends quickly. This object is more than 3 meters long and is surrounded by flames. It rises again shortly after its descent. In view of this splendid and amazing spectacle, I rush to the village to alert the inhabitants. When my friends come out of their houses, a flying machine has disappeared. After the event, I reflect on it very much, but do not find a reasonable explanation. I have the impression I have come out of a long dream. I hasten to write down all that I have seen at the time so that whoever understands these events can give me an explanation. Well, this is 13th century China, okay? I get letters like this from readers of my books today. Exactly, almost the same words. I have the impression I've come out of a dream. I have no reasonable explanation. Please explain this to me. I wrote it down as I saw it. You know, it's a completely modern description.
As you note in the book, these things are described as omens and portents here and there. They can, in fact, change the course of history in some cases.
They were seen, of course, anything in the sky at that time was interpreted by people, usually official astrologers and so on, certainly in the early centuries, as announcing things or being guided by God, by whatever God they were worshiping.
You know, you say that you would like to invite a whole new generation of researchers to become involved in this. Maybe by the end of the program, we can tell anybody in our audience, if they're interested in helping to contribute, how they can contact you or Chris, your co-author, and how, in fact, they can contribute, because it sounds like you need a lot of foot soldiers to get this done.
Yes, and we need people who speak Japanese and Chinese and people who can read ancient Egyptian and so on, but we're very much aware that we're just at the beginning of this.
We are just beginning our interview with Dr. Jacques Vallée about his wonderful new book called Wonders in the Sky. When we come back, we'll jump into some specific cases, including some of the biblical events that have been described as perhaps UFO incidents over the years. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, everyone. My guest, Dr. Jacques Vallée, here to talk about his new book called Wonders in the Sky. He looks at cases, UFO cases, from antiquity to the advent of the Industrial Revolution. Here's one of them. October 14th, 1253 in England, Nicholas of Findern reported to Burton Abbey that about an hour of vespers, the sky being clear, suddenly a large bright star appeared out of a black cloud with two smaller stars in the vicinity. A battle royal soon commenced, the small stars charging the great star again and again, so it began to diminish in size, and sparks of fire fell from the combatants. This continued for a considerable time, and at last the spectators, stupefied by fear and wonder, and ignorant of what it might portend, fled. Not exactly a meteor sighting, not exactly a swamp gas. An amazing case from long, long ago, and this book is filled with them. We'll talk about some of those cases, including biblical-type cases, when we come back with our guest, Dr. Jacques Vallée, here on Coast to Coast AM. Before the break, my guest, Dr. Jacques Vallée, commented that he hopes that this book will provide an impetus for a whole new generation of scholars, scientists, historians, anthropologists to become involved in collecting these stories and putting together a comprehensive long-term view of it. However, in his book, Wonders in the Sky, he writes, "So why hasn't science taken notice, given the robust nature of the phenomenon and the enormous interest it elicits among the public? You'd think that interdisciplinary teams of historians, anthropologists, sociologists, and scientists would rush to study it." And then he notes that Stephen Hawking makes this wisecrack where he says, "I'm discounting reports of UFOs. Why would they appear only to cranks and weirdos?" Jacques, how do you overcome that? You've been at this for 40 years and plugging away and doing really good work, solid, scientifically grounded work, and yet the mainstream guys still don't come around to this thing.
Well, I've been at it more than 4 years, as you have, George. And Stephen Hawking is somebody I admire enormously. He's one of the great astronomers, one of the great cosmologists of our time. He just hasn't looked at the material. And that's very typical of a lot of the academic community. They have not been exposed to the actual data. And I hope that, he and his colleagues will take the time to look at this. I'm encouraged by the fact that now, you know, pilots are coming out and telling their stories, military people, as in the book by Leslie Keene recently, people are no longer afraid of telling their stories, and you find that they come from, in fact, from people who are not weirdos and cranks. And certainly in this material, in these 500 cases, most of them came from official people, from people who were advisors to kings, in some cases came from the king and his officers. And I think that it's just a matter of putting that material before people so that they can judge by themselves.
So anybody who looks at it with an open mind can't help but be impressed and be interested.
Well, they would, again, they don't have to buy into any particular theory. We're not smart enough, I think, at this point, to have a theory that really accounts for all of this material. It's very complex. It's very difficult. We don't have all the data. But, for example, there is November 1st, 1461, in France, in Arras. The witness is Jacques Duclair, legal advisor to Philippe III. He writes, quote, "On this day of our Lord, All Saints' Day, There appeared in the sky an object as bright as burning steel, as long and wide as half of the moon. It was stationary for 15 minutes. Well, you know, what was it? I mean, it wasn't a meteor. It wasn't a comet. Suddenly, the strange object began to spiral upwards. And then it spun around and rolled over like a loose watch spring, after which it disappeared in the sky. Now, he publishes this in the memoir of Jacques Duclair on the about the reign of Philippe le Bon, Duke of Burgundy. And this was published in Brussels in 1836. Okay, so you just have to trace, and this is where Chris and his team were remarkable. They traced back all these cases one by one and did the critical analysis. And by the way, there are lots of stories. You know, you hear people will come to me and say, well, what about India? You know, what about the Vedanta? They talk about the legend of God flying around in machines. What about the Hopi have a tradition of a beautiful maiden coming down from the sky in a basket and so on. Well, that's fine, but those are stories. They have tremendous cultural significance, but I can't do very much with them as a scientist. We made the rule that we would only take cases that had a date and hopefully a time and a place, and in many cases the name of the witness. And most of our cases have all of that. We relaxed the rule in the early centuries, but after the 13th and 14th century, we enforced the rule that we wanted a precise date and a precise place. We're not dealing with legends and, you know, cultural traditions and so on. We're dealing with actual recorded facts.
Well, you've got one of the oldest ones, and I was asking you before the break about cases that might have affected human development, human culture. One of the oldest ones you cite on page 29 of your book is in the Nile Valley of Egypt, 1347 BC, and this involved the Pharaoh Akhenaten, who had his own experience, saw this thing float down. It was described as a shining disc, and you know, you don't see the disc description in throughout the 500 cases that you have here, but this guy actually described it as a disc. He went on to found a new religion based on the worship of what he called the solar disc, and basically established his immortality. That's a big one.
Yes, he founded a new civilization and a new religion, and he this is actually recorded again in a stela. And again, in those days, of course, there was no paper, and important events like that were actually engraved in stone, and that's how they have come to us. So that shows again how important people felt that it was, and how relevant it was to their history and their society.
How much weight do you give to cases in the Bible that you don't have a specific date, you know, approximately when it might have happened, but you know that it's been rewritten over time by different scholars, biblical scholars? The prophet Elijah, for example, you mentioned that he had an experience in 850 BC or around there.
Yes, and the most significant, I think, from the events described in the Bible is probably Ezekiel, because Ezekiel is very detailed. There are different interpretations of what he wrote, and of course what we have in the Bible was written centuries after Ezekiel's death, but it was written from the tradition that he left and that crossed the centuries. What he describes is very interesting because he uses words that are used only once in the Bible, and he even uses a word that's used only once in the language of the time. So he was obviously very distraught and very disoriented by what he saw. It's a classic abduction. And by the way, people studying abduction believe that abductions were started recently, and I'm sure you've interviewed some of these authors, that it's a recent phenomenon and it shows a new phase in the phenomenon. And that's not true. I mean, abductions go back. There are many cases of abductions in our chronology, in our records. Ezekiel was transported to a faraway mountain, and he was in shock. And what he describes were wheels within wheels, and he describes four beings that left him completely confounded. I should mention that the book, I think, what the some of the richness of the book comes from the fact that Chris and I didn't agree on everything, which is always healthy in science. Chris is a much more precise and exacting scholar than I am. And I was, we had discussions, not fights, because we, you know, I really admire what he does. And, but we had strong discussions and arguments about some of the cases. I was more willing to include cases where we didn't have all the documentation, all the references, and even cases that didn't actually include a an object per se, but you know, some form of contact with a non-human voice or a non-human form. And he insisted that we should only focus on aerial objects as opposed to more vague phenomena, and that we should always have a reference. We compromised, and in the book you'll see a little eye with a circle around it, which means this is a case where we need more information, and it's really an appeal to the reader or to people who have more information to help us. I won some of those arguments because I said, look, we know that there may be a case here. If we don't call it to the attention of people, we'll never know more because people are not going to go back and do their research. So it's our duty to publish it, but with a note of caution that we don't know as much as we wanted to about this particular case. In some cases, we don't have a complete reference. So that's how we compromised. And obviously, in a case like Ezekiel, we have to say that we are not in a position to make a complete statement about it. Many of the other cases, we are in such a position because we have traced it to the actual original record.
Well, your comment about abductions and how far back they go is well taken. Looking through this book, I'm amazed at how far back they go and how widespread they are. There's a case from the year 760 in France where the witnesses see this aerial ship battle, these ships fighting it out in the sky, and four of these guys are abducted by aerial beings. And there are other stories in the book about during the Inquisition, the period of the Inquisition, abductions happened, and of course, given the times, people associated the events with witchcraft, and there were some tragic results, figuring anybody who gets abducted and is consorting with people in the sky must be a witch, let's burn them.
Yes, right? Exactly. And in, of course, in the Arab tradition, many of these beings from the sky were called the jinns, or the jinni, or the jinn. And, of course, that tradition is very interesting, also from a cultural and religious point of view.
What do you make of these aerial battles? Because we see that in France, in this case in 760, with the Indian example that you talked about. Ancient India had these giant battles. In England, they had giant battles. What are these people seeing? And, of course, I know you don't want to get into theories because you don't do that in the book, but just speaking as Jacques Vallée and not as the co-author of this thing.
Well, it's very puzzling, and Chris and I have had many discussions back and forth about this. Of course, there are cases in the U.S. of UFOs engaging in what people describe as dogfights. I remember seeing cases like that in the Blue Book fight. So it may be just a description of erratic movements of objects in the sky that are interpreted as a battle. In other cases, we just don't know what they saw. And I'm sure that the book will be criticized, if not attacked, by historians and in a legitimate way, saying, look, you know, a sighting in the 7th century in France is not on the same level, on the same playing field as something in the 17th century, in Germany. And we know that. So we've divided the chronology one century at a time with an introduction and an epilogue for every century, summarizing what was going on in that particular period, culturally, in terms of communication, Well, the invention of paper, for example, the invention of the printing press, the invention of the telegraph, the different modes of communication, patterns of urbanization, and so on. I mean, we are not completely ignorant of those things, and that communication in the 17th century was not what it was, you know, in the Dark Ages. And so we try to place these descriptions in their linguistic and cultural context as much as we can, and obviously put it in a modern language, but in a modern interpretation, but without losing the framework.
I want to mention this case in particular. I guess maybe you owe a debt of gratitude to Saint Agobard in France,
yes.
815, because he wrote about Magonia and these abductees from Magonia. And apparently the stories of abductions and things in the sky were so common that sort of an underground theory had developed among the people that there must be a place called Magonia where all these ships come from. And this guy wrote, oh, no, don't believe that. That's crazy. You can't believe in a place called Magonia, right?
Well, Agobard was a remarkable man. He was one of the great scholars of his time, wrote 22 books in Latin. He was the Archbishop of Lyon in the 9th century, played an important political role after the death of Emperor Charlemagne, was exiled for a while and came back to Lyon. The Archbishop of Lyon was almost as powerful as the king. So he carried considerable weight. And he wrote books against superstitions. He was, in a way, he was a rationalist, even though he was an archbishop. And in one of his books called About Thunder and Lightning, he says that the people of his district were so crazy that they thought there was this unknown land above the clouds called Magonia, where these ships were coming from. And that one day, the people brought to the church four humans in chains, three men and one woman, who had come down from one of those flying ships. And obviously, as you said, they must be witches because they came from a flying ship. So they wanted to kill them. And he preached to them and said that there couldn't be flying ships, that this was a complete superstition, and that they should let these people go. And so he, in a way, saved their life because he was a non-believer in UFOs. You know, so it shows that skeptics can be useful sometimes.
You know, a lot of these things that appear in the sky, they do take on religious overtones. People think of them as a religious sighting. There are instances mentioned in your book, including one from Italy in the year 1001, where somebody sees these strange lights and then a luminous lady. They figure it's got to be Virgin Mary. That pops up a lot, where things are seen in the sky and they are given religious import, whether or not it fits or not.
Well, one of the secret pleasures, sinful pleasures of working with this material is to look at how people explained it, because there was always some wise guy in the crowd who had an explanation. Usually they would go to, you know, a great scholar or a religious leader, and he would say, well, you know, this thing represents, you know, the Pope, and this other thing represents our bad king, and it shows that, you know, religion will triumph, or it shows that England will be defeated, or it shows that people should pray and renounce their sins. You know, they had all these explanations, just like, you know, the Air Force today, explaining it as, it must be the planet Venus, even though it was seen in the north, or it must be some comet, even though it crossed the sky in 10 minutes, you know. So it's one of the secret pleasures.
It's in a way, it's like the precursor to disinformation. The church had its own version of Phil Klass back in the Middle Ages or something. Oh, yeah, this is God's work here. You better straighten up and tie to the church or something like that. Or, you know, using these kinds of cases to get the people in line.
Yes, but when you go back to the actual record, you find that it's absolutely similar or parallel to what people are seeing today, which we still can't explain.
Well, that's what I wonder. And I know you maybe don't want to get into that in a discussion with the book itself, but the idea that maybe we are seeing the same things, but they were seeing the same sort of things, but the appearances took it on a different form. And I know that's entirely speculative in our part, that maybe whatever this is, this entity, this intelligence, it appears to us in different forms. And we'll get into that after this break, continuing our fascinating discussion with Dr. Jacques Vallée about his new book, Wonders in the Sky. Don't go away, everyone. We'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM.